Inside joke. Going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:34 p.m. on Monday, May 8th, 2023. And present today we have with us Representative Joseph Snow, Representative Hannon. We've got Co-Chair Representative Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, Representative Ortiz, Representative Colomb, Representative Stapp, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Foster. And if folks can mute their cell phones, today we're going to pick up where we left off with HGR 2 and HB 38, which are the spending limits, both constitutional and statutory. The order in which we're going to take up the next two bills, we're going to reverse them. So we had pharmacy first and then the insurance second, but Representative Vance needs to go to her. She's delayed her committee in order to attend this, and so we want to just make sure we've got time for her. So we'll take up HB 21, which is school and university employee health insurance, and then we'll go to House Bill 112, which is profession of pharmacy, and those are both introduction bills. Introductory. We'll do introductions to those two. So first up, just picking up where we left off, if Mr. Alexi Painter could come to the table, legislative analyst. And mostly I believe he was finished with his slideshow, but wanted to open it up to questions for both him, Representative Stapp, and his staff, Mr. Otto, if you also wanted to come to the table. So with that, does the committee have questions regarding the constitutional or spending limit bills? Representative Colomb, then Ortiz.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. Can you hear me?
Not hearing you very well. Let's see. We had this problem with my mic. Oh, there we go. We can hear you good now.
All right. So through the chair, Mr. Painter, I just want to get on record a question that I had asked you on the side. So when there's revenue that is put into accounts, the ERA account, or if they capitalize a fund, put money in the higher education fund, is that in the spending cap?
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. So specifically, one of the exclusions in the appropriation limit in the existing one and that's maintained is any appropriation that's in this, in this slide. So the legislature may exceed this limit in bills for appropriations to the Alaska Permanent Fund. So any appropriation to the permanent fund can exceed the limit and does not count. In addition, when we're calculating the limit, we do not include any fund, any appropriations that require further appropriation to spend. So if you put money into, say, the statutory budget reserve and then you have to appropriate it out, we wouldn't say that putting it into the appropriation, into the statutory budget reserve counts as an appropriation for the limit, since that's just moving it into a savings account. We would count it if we actually put it into someplace where it's actually spent.
So follow up. So if we were to put money in the higher education fund, that is subject to the cap because it's appropriated.
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, it would not be subject to the cap because we have to appropriate out of that fund. So the appropriations into the fund would not be in the limit, but appropriations out of that fund would be. So you don't want to double count that, right? And so you'd count it on the way out because that's when it's actually going out of the Treasury.
Okay, thank you.
I also want to recognize Representative Co-Chair Edgman is also with us, and next in the queue we have Representative Ortiz and then Galvin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Painter, I think I'm correct in understanding that this particular spending cap does not include the PFD and does not include the capital budget, correct? Is that correct to both of those things?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it does not include the PFD. It does include the capital budget. However, there's the ability to exceed the statutory appropriation limit for capital expenditures with a two-thirds vote. And even then, it cannot exceed the constitutional cap. So the capital budget is included, but it's treated a little bit differently in that there's a way to expand, go beyond the statutory limit for the capital budget. No, I believe that's all correct.
Follow up. And so with that understanding, is it safe to say then that impact of this particular constitutional and statutory limit on spending is in effect a limit on the operating budget pretty much by itself. Is that, would that be the effect?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, to some extent, yes, but there, since it does take a two-thirds vote to exceed it for capital expenditures, there still would be an impact. It just, you could not exceed it for the operating, but with capital, you'd have a higher vote threshold to be able to exceed the statutory limit.
And finally,
over.
And I think this is a policy question, not a political question. With this, if it were to be adopted, would it act as an effective spending limit when the PFD, which is our current biggest spending item, isn't a part of the limit?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it would act as a limit on expenditures for all other items. It would not limit how much you could spend on a PFD.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd also like to recognize that we're joined by Representative Josephson, Representative Galvin. Representative Galvin's got the next question.
Yes, thank you. I'm looking at the expenses for education. And I recognize that previously we've pretty much used BSA as a regular formula, and then we've oftentimes had funds come in outside the formula to sort of keep up with what we know were the costs that were going up. And I guess what I'm trying to picture is, what does it look like if, I know that typically you're looking at the last 5 years of inflation and then averaging is what my understanding is. And my concern is, what if we get a major bump up in inflation for the last 2 years? So the costs of education are so much higher. What would happen? Would it be then a two-thirds vote in order to keep what we have, the people in place in schools, or is it, how would that play out?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, so the limit is calculated based on a five-year average of GDP adjusted for inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was a spike in inflation in the current year, that would all be captured in that inflation adjustment to the prior year GDP figures. So to the extent that the inflation is not happening currently, it's, so if we were in this current session, for example, mm-hmm. the spending limit were in effect, we'd be using last year's inflation for the calculation, which was 8%. So that would entirely be incorporated through that real GDP calculation. However, if we were in last year's legislature, where real inflation experienced in the world was 8%, but that wasn't part of the calculation yet, it would be harder to, you know, that would not necessarily be reflected that year, but it would be reflected this session when that's part of the official number. So that's always kind of an inherent tension in a spending limit. If you're trying to set it based on prior year inflation, you can do that and have an amount that's known, and that's how the current, how the proposed limit works. If you do it based on projected inflation, you can adjust minute to minute by what's happening in the real world, but that number is unknown during session, and that means that we don't know what the spending limit is, we just have an estimate. And so there's just an inherent trade-off. You can either have one that adjusts for the inflation in the current year, and it'll be an unknown number right now, or you can have one that's a known number, but it's using last year's inflation. You really, I don't know any way to have both.
And one quick follow-up. So the other question I have is related to this, and that is where we start the floor is starting at a place where we know we haven't kept up with inflation. I'm leading with education. Because that's our second cost, right? Other than healthcare and PFD, this is our big spend. It's a really big spend, and I just worry about this if we know, for example, that we haven't kept up with inflation and early learning. My goodness, we have the least amount per capita in the whole United States. So let's say what if our floor is starting at what isn't caught up, and then we go from there, and we're strapped into where we are now, which would be then if it's just 2.5%, let's say, and that's the only incremental increase we could make. Wouldn't that kind of put us in a place that starts already at behind?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I would say that it's a policy choice of the legislature of where to start that limit.
Okay.
And you could set it wherever you would like in through this legislation.
Thank you. And then through the chair, if I may, in looking at the previous budgetary spend on education, would you agree that we haven't had incremental increases in the last, let's say, 7 years that would have kept up with inflation?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, right, the BSA has increased by $30 this year and previously had not increased since FY17, I believe.
And would you, for the record, help remind us what percentage that would be, $30 incremental increase? What was that?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that's about 0.5%.
So 0.05% or 0.5% is $30.
Through the chair, about
0.5. Okay. Thank you. So that's for the last year, and then before that, it was not even 0.5. So again, to my point, that floor, and I know this is a policy decision, I guess, co-chair, but I just want us to all be very mindful that where we set our floor, I think, is really important when it comes to education, especially given what we're hearing from Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Alto?
For the record, Bernard Alto, staff to Representative Stapp, through the chair to Representative Galvin. In this case, under the proposal, the floor is that percentage that's based on the 5-year trailing average of GDP. If I recall correctly, and I don't know the exact amount, but the 5-year trailing average, if applied to this year, will be about $21 billion, and we are taking about 11% of that in this proposal. So the percentage is the floor, and that percentage would equal to about $4.9 billion in the HB 38 and about $5.1 billion in HJR 2. So when we're talking about adjusting the floor, that could really be hashed out through those percentages.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Would you translate that to BSA dollars?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin. So in the earlier proposal or in the earlier presentation, it was stated that about a percentage increase to the limit would be about $475 million. I believe with the proposed increase to the BSA, about $680 increase, that equal to about, and you can correct me, Director Boehner, but about $175 million increase. So by increasing the percentage about 1%, you would be able to spend more in the BSA or other things for that matter.
So thank you. Through the chair, if I may, I appreciate this information. So given what you're sharing, instead of it being a 175 incremental increase, that's we still don't know if that's in or outside the BSA. If we were to follow these numbers, then we would be looking at a 475, which sounds to me like that would bring us closer to one of the bills that we might have for the BSA. Am I hearing that right?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, the increase in percentage would increase the amount to spend about $475 million. What the legislature decides to appropriate with that $475 million is up to the legislature, but that increasing the percentages increases the amount you can spend.
Thank you. So through the chair, what I'm hearing then is that if we were to use these rules as you have them written, then there is $475 available, but how it gets spent would be the choice of the legislature, whether they want to make that as part of what we're calling the floor of education or not.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, the legislature has the power of appropriation and they can appropriate however they want to, as long as it's in line with current law and the Constitution.
Thank you.
Okay. I do have Representative Josephson and Ortiz, but I do want to give the bill sponsor a chance to respond to these questions. So, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, to the members of the committee. So just trying to simplify it, any type of appropriation limit has to be tied to something. Our existing appropriation limit is tied to a hard number. The bills before you are just tied to a percent of the gross overall economic outcome of the state currently. So if you feel that the caps are too, or the percentages are too draconian, if you amend those upwards, you create more space in the budget to appropriate money for operating and capital expenditures. And to an earlier point regarding the statutory limit in HB 38, if that percentage is amended upward as well, in theory, you could have capital expenditures fall underneath that statutory appropriation as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be reserved for the entirety of the operating budget, if that makes sense. And feel free to comment on that if you would, too. Thanks.
Okay. I don't see anybody jumping at that, so we will go over to Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair. I think for Mr. Otto, my understanding is that according to, I don't know if it's the bill or the resolution, but I recall the number $5.8 billion. And my question is, neither the bill nor resolution ask or require a division between capital and operating. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I believe it was $5.1 billion for the HJR2 under the 13%, and I think it's like $4.8 billion for the statutory 11%, if I'm getting where you're asking correct. The amounts under, if implemented by fiscal year 24, that's what the dollar amounts would be, if I'm interpreting that correctly.
Let me re-clarify. Regardless of what either HJR 2 or 38 would allow, unlike the constitutional limit now, which speaks to this division between capital and operating, these measures don't do that. Is that right? They have a single limit, a unified limit.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I believe they do have a singular limit. However, there is a provision in that Director Painter had alluded to under page 2, line that starts on page 2, line 4, which states upon an affirmative vote of 2/3 of the membership of each house, and this is in HJR 2. Upon an affirmative vote of 2/3 of the membership of each house, the legislature may appropriate an additional amount for capital improvements in excess of the limit under this section, except that the total amount appropriated shall not exceed an amount equal to 13% of the average calculated under this section.
Follow? I guess where I'm going is, to the extent a 2/3 vote wasn't called for, that the predicate question would be, when you arrived at 11 and 13%, what did you anticipate for capital expenditures? That's the predicate question.
Representative Scott?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the Chair, Representative Jefferson. So the 11 and 13% numbers were amended in the previous committee referral downward. So my argument would be, like, it's important to have an appropriation limit, but we also don't want something that encumbers our ability to make investments in the state. And I think you can probably achieve a happy medium if those percentages were amended upward, if that makes sense.
Follow up?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Stapp, it does. But I still am curious. You must have had a target of dollars. We know that one of them is $100 million in excess of the current budget. I guess where I'm going, I just want to know the size of the capital budget under this, notwithstanding, or rather in the event we don't get a 2/3 vote. What is our capital outlay?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Josephson, it would be any type of appropriation that fell within the statutory limit of the bill in that case. And like I said, that can also be amended in the committee. And I'll defer to my staff here to finish the answer to the question.
Through the chair, for the record, Bernard Otto, through the chair to Representative Josephson. So if I don't remember the exact amounts correctly, so, but I believe it's about $4.8 billion. So without a 2/3 vote, the capital budget would fall within that $4.9 or $4.8 billion amount. So it would be the operating budget plus whatever the capital budget would be would have to equal $4.9 billion if the legislature did not want to or have the votes necessary to reach the two-thirds.
Last question.
Representative Josephson.
I couldn't get where I wanted to be, but notwithstanding that, could a legislature suffocate hard word, but the word of my choice, the capital budget to the bare minimum, the $100 million that everyone hears about, and supplant and grow operating budgets that way?
Representative Stapp.
Something you brought up in Ways and Means.
So through the chair to Representative Josephson, so I'm going to try to extrapolate the meaning of the question. So basically, are you asking if you could effectively spend the entirety of the operating budget up to a cap number and just not have a capital budget? Is that the question?
Representative Josephson?
Yes, the de minimis match, which is around $100 million.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Josephson, yeah. Under any type of limitation that's possible, even under our current constitutional limit, you could in theory do that if you had enough available revenue. I don't think the legislature would ever intentionally suffocate the capital budget. But I would argue we actually have the ability to do that currently, too, if we wanted to.
Representative Josephson?
Question through the chair for Representative Stapp. So even if our revenue could have floated all boats and satisfied virtually every need, that's what the Parnell administration saw. $95 million 2 years in a row for the Susitna-Wontana Dam. Everyone got something in his budget. But even if that were the circumstance, it could, for example, under my hypothetical, if you wanted a BSA increase and you were an advocate of that, you would be at odds with people who want a larger capital budget, right? So I guess what I'm saying is here we would have plenty of money to satisfy the capital budget interests and the public school advocates, but they'd both be battling for space. Am I right?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I suppose you could articulate that way. I mean, my argument would be that's kind of the nature of the battle currently, right? I mean, we're battling whether or not we're looking at permanent increases in the operating budget versus larger capital expenditures. I think personally I would argue, this course policy call, personally I'd argue that a threshold to achieve capital budget is generally a more equitable solution for the bulk of the majority of the legislature. So I would hope that due to the nature of the vote threshold, you would be more likely to get a more robust capital budget that satisfies the needs of the entirety of the state rather than limited amount. So, but I'm sure that's just probably an extrapolating difference. So,
and
Mr. Otto?
If I could, for the record, Bernardo Otto, and through the chair to Representative Josephson, and to just expand upon Representative Stapp's point, that seems like the sort of situation that the legislature is in now, but that's not because of a cap, that's because of a lack of revenue. And in most cases, over the past several years, it has been due to a lack of revenue, not necessarily due to a cap.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, yes, I understand, Mr. Otto, but under your proposal, we could have all the revenue we want and we couldn't spend beyond the cap to solve problems that we identify. Isn't that true?
Mr. Odo?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, there are a list of exceptions in which the legislature could appropriate, one of which being disaster declarations by the governor, and the amount of exceptions and what is subject to the limit and not subject to the limit is also a policy call by the legislature.
Okay, in the queue, I've got Representative Ortiz, Johnson, and Hannon. Oops. Good, okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just, for clarification, the green, which is the POMV revenue, that's the full amount of the POMV revenue that we would draw under the percent of market value, not statutory or earnings or... It's POMV revenue, I see that, but it's not, like, split out in any way.
Through the chair, for the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance, through the chair, Representative Johnson, correct. That's the entire POMV draw. We currently show the entire draw as UGF revenue, and then the permanent fund dividend is a UGF expenditure.
Thank you. So I guess I'm just trying to wrap my head around some of the concerns that people have. Some say they will not want to see a spending limit until they don't want to see any taxes without a spending limit. But then we get into the fact that the PFD is not under the spending limit, so you kind of get, I mean, we're getting into a lot of circular, you know, pieces to this. And if we don't take out 50% of the revenue for the PFD, then we're not really considering the PFD in this equation very much. Because you, if you're not considering the revenue, I mean, if you're just considering the spend, but you keep the all 100% of the revenue, I don't know, I just wanted to make note of that on this graph.
Okay.
And, well, I guess for the sponsor, I would like to say, I guess I would like to ask, you know, if you would expand on that kind of natural tension between people that don't want to have any new taxes unless they have a spending limit, but yet say that, you know, the question about having the dividend under the cap or outside of the cap and how that affects the spending limit and taxes and so on.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, to the Chair, Co-Chair Johnson. So I think I can probably best articulate that on slide 13. So as you can see on slide 13, which is a proposed 15% limit on constitutional limit on GDP, you'll find that the constitutional limit, aka our joint resolution, would effectively put all available revenue in this fiscal year within the cap, irrespective of the dividend appropriation. So the cut to the chase on that, this version at 15% of GDP, if you effectively had a zero dividend, you could appropriate all of that money for government expenditures if you so chose to do so. And when you play with the percentages under the cap, you can effectively make those types of policy calls. This is what we're currently looking at is the current version in the other body of the same bill, the companion. So my argument is I choose to leave the dividend out for lots of different reasons. At the end of the day, I don't think it super pertains to what we're trying to achieve by an appropriation limit, though I would certainly recognize that it is the largest appropriation the legislature makes. But in the event that this variation of the version were to pass, you would still have to make that policy call. Because doing simple math, if you were appropriating half of POMB toward PFDs, you would not have enough revenue to reach the current limits unless you added new revenues to the legislature, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Follow up.
Well, thank you. It does make sense. And I guess that idea that it doesn't seem to me putting the dividend under the cap or outside the cap or because it's tied to GDP and not actually to a balanced budget or so on and so forth, that has a different effect than it seems like we're conflating a lot of the different effects of different pieces that are go into different types of spending caps. But and for clarity, I just wanted to make sure that we're making note that it's a GDP. It's not based on other types of you know, the traditional spending cap pieces.
Mr. Odo or Mr. Painter, I don't know if there's. It might have just been more of a comment, or was it a question?
No, I think I'm not as good at asking a question within a comment. So, yeah, I would love to hear what he has to say about that, if anything.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I guess, you know, a comment I would make is that as a legislature, often our appropriations are constrained by revenue. And so any spending limit is not going to matter as much when revenue is the constraint. The time that a spending limit would matter are years like last session when revenue is not a constraint. I mean, I guess it is to a limit. We could have, you know, we saw the $5,500 dividend still with a balanced budget last year, but there is still a revenue constraint. It was just very high. But there are years like last year where there's not a meaningful revenue constraint. The constraint would be a desire not to spend all of the money. that's what a spending limit serves to do, is to cap the high years, essentially. So it's not trying necessarily. I mean, you can set a limit that's low enough that at times of oil prices like we're seeing now in the $70 range, that it would cap you at $70 oil. You know, the other way to see a spending limit is that caps you when you have that random year of $100 oil or $85 oil, whatever it is that would remove that that revenue constraint on expenditures, it would provide a different constraint.
And if I could expand,
Mr. Otto?
For the record, Bernard Otto, and to through the chair to co-chair Johnson, the value of using a GDP-based spending cap is that it encaptures many different sort of aspects of the economy that the legislature should be paying attention to. There are things like general population and inflation, but encompassing GDP also allows the legislature to look to factor in things such as consumer spending, business spending, net imports and net exports, things that the legislature should be accounting for in their economy when deciding how to appropriate, and not just tying it to a simple metric of either personal income or population or business spending, but encompassing it all into a holistic approach. I think there were previous iterations of spending caps that tried to use one aspect of population inflation and many different iterations of it, and it resulted in a more draconian or restrictive spending cap than what this proposal aims to do.
Representative Johnson?
So when it comes to a floor on government spending, I mean, if you were to envision any time where the GDP spending cap would be so low that you'd really get below the amount being able to be spent on services that are basic needs that we have decided that that's what the government is going to provide, does the POMV draw pretty much cover, will it cover, do we not have to have a floor because the POMV is always in there to get us at least up and above if we chose to? I'm trying to envision a spending cap that would force us into some kind of austerity that we don't want to see happen, but yet we do have, we don't have the balanced budget piece of it. We just have the GDP. So the dividend, not the dividend, but the permanent fund draw would always provide us with the amount of money if it were based like a balanced budget. I'm trying to make it clear what I'm trying to say. But is there ever a time where the GDP spending limit would ever force us in, you know, just because for whatever things completely fell apart, it would be so low that we really wouldn't be able to meet the needs of Alaskans?
Representative Stout?
yeah, through the chair to Representative Johnson. So there's two answers, I think, to the question. First would be, in the event that you had, it's called like a fiscal disaster, where you had multi-years of down GDP growth, my opinion would be you would be more likely to see a revenue limit than you would need a spending limit. Although I would say if you had serious GDP drop for 5 years, it's a five-year average rolling, you could see a decrease in the spending limit. In theory, that would have massive out-migration as well. My argument would be, just like in the end of the 80s, when the state lost thousands of people to out-migration, the state government adjusted its spending downward to accommodate that. So in the event that we did have some sort of disaster scenario where we had 200,000 people leave our state, we probably would be wise to reevaluate our spending levels. I don't personally foresee that scenario, but I'd be happy to shift it over to Director Painter if he would like to kind of elaborate on the question further.
Mr. Painter?
Through the chair, Representative, I guess I'd point to the history here of, you know, we set this limit starting in FY83. Expenditures were pretty close to the limit for the first few years, and then when we had that economic disaster, essentially spending was flat for, you know, nearly two decades, and so the limit was not a meaningful factor for those two decades. You know, you could see something similar with a GDP limit, although, you know, likely there would have been, the limit would not have grown as quickly as the population plus inflation, because GDP would have taken a hit from that as well. But I think during that past period where we saw that economic disaster, really the limit was not what limited our expenditures, it was revenue.
Okay. We got Representative Hannon, Galvin, and Josephson. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Representative Johnson started asking the questions, but I guess I'm just looking to hear a little more from the sponsor about the view of excluding the PFD, our largest single expense, from these spending caps. And for comparison to our current one, I get that. But in designing a new one, it seems to hold that out even above limits on some of our constitutionally mandated spends. So a little more from you on why you're holding the PFD outside of the spending cap.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Hannon. I'll be happy to articulate again. So in my opinion, kind of PFD is kind of a separate political issue that requires its own resolution. I would argue you could amend the percentages of the cap to encompass all the available revenue, like I demonstrated before in the slide. I don't know, I think it was 14 at 15% constitutional limit. It would certainly be interesting to do. The PFD over the last several years has been subject to a huge swing and variation of appropriation. So if I did fix a hard limit in the bill, I would be effectively making that policy call on the dividend within the spending cap, which is not something that I would really like to do, because I think that, you know, whatever dividend amount you would decide on, I would effectively have to decide on within the framework of the constitutional spending limit. So that's aspect number two. And the third answer is, if all available revenue falls under the cap, then, you know, you can infer a dividend amount within that if you'd like, you know, because currently you're constrained by revenue, especially if oil price drops $10. So
Follow up,
actually. Slightly different line of thinking, looking for the sponsor. So thank you, Representative Foster. I am curious in the research of this whether you found any jurisdictions where a spending cap is set separate from a taxation policy. Because, of course, right now in Alaska we have no individual taxes. And so most states that have taken it on, it's either in response to a sales tax or an income tax, or statewide property taxes, and trying to put a governor on those things. And, you know, you've used the term in your sponsor statement, a financialized revenue stream based on just investment income, I'm paraphrasing from yours, and wondering whether you found any jurisdictions where those didn't go hand in hand, where you haven't put in place some revenues at the same time you're talking about a spending cap. So the spend is on the revenues you're intending to generate, not on ones that are financialized.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Hannon. Well, thanks for quoting my excellently well-written sponsor statement. I appreciate that. So if I could just rephrase the question, was it basically you were asking me if I, during the research, I found a spending cap that was divorced from taxation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I would say the current spending cap the state of Alaska has no bearing on taxation, neither does Colorado. Any spending cap that's indexed to population and inflation, by definition, has no bearing on kind of tax policy. It's just a metric they use to tie. I would even argue that GDP is probably a better metric to use in the event that you were looking to coordinate some sort of tax policy. The reason being is if you have a more robust and healthy private sector, you have a bit better base to implement taxes, and GDP is a good metric of determining that.
Follow up.
Thank you, Representative Foster. I want to ignore Alaska in that example because we are the example of we've got a spending cap without a taxation policy. And certainly in Colorado, my recollection is that spending cap dialogue immediately followed tax increases. So that's what I'm looking to see is there any jurisdiction besides us who've set a spending cap without also addressing taxation policies in their state? Capping first and then discussing tax.
Yeah, through the chair.
That's kind of what we're doing here.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Hamm. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah, I would say that obviously Alaska doesn't have broad-based tax, so every other state has some sort of a broad-based tax. So, yeah, generally the concept behind revenue, rather appropriation limits, are always to give some sort of control mechanism for responsible government in terms of appropriation. So I can't think of any example off the top of my head outside of Alaska, because every other state has some sort of broad-based tax in that argument. So,
thank you.
Okay, I've got Representative Galvin, Josephson, and Ortiz. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I've been wrapping my head around really, I guess, what I would consider macroeconomics and whether or not a spending cap is bringing what I think of Alaskan voters are looking for, and that would be, you know, more transparency and accountability and certainly responsiveness. It's been brought to my attention that there's a briefing paper by the Economic Policy Institute that discusses this a little bit and talks about spending caps not necessarily drawing us closer as a state to that transparency piece. And so I think it's because when we're given these specific parameters, sometimes what happens is when there's a shock to the system, and I'm going to talk about the 2008 collapse, because I think that's one of the main examples that I hear people refer to about in this discussion. And then 2008, Alaska was fine, as it turns out. We weren't as hit as hard, but in the U.S. at large, because it had the capability of investing very quickly, and this is my question to you, I think, Alexei, if I may. At that point, we had a sudden shock, and because we were able to invest, and it was a lot of money, over 25% by far, into the U.S. economy, we were able to save over 700,000 jobs, for example. So I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit and what this looks like if we get some sort of a shock like that. Similarly, other kinds of, I'm going to call them disasters. I'm not sure that the governor would have called that a disaster, because, and that's my other concern, because I think that's the one space I see in here where the governor can go outside is if he sees a disaster. So I'd also like to hear about your thoughts about what a disaster, how that would be defined. I didn't see it defined, but I think about, is it a pandemic? Is it a natural disaster? Is it students not learning? Where do we see that as a place that we need to go beyond the spending cap?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I'll start with your second question first. So there's a definition of disaster that's in statute, so I think that would probably be where that would be tied to. The governor has powers to declare disasters for natural disasters or, you know, disease, war, violence, you know, sorts of things that, you know, that's listed. I don't believe economic disasters are included in that. To your first question, which was about, you know, if GDP crashes, would a GDP-based spending limit mean that you cannot respond? I think if it were severe enough, potentially, but it is a five-year average with a lag. So if we were looking at right now, we, you know, this session, and if it were in place, we'd be looking at the last year of GDP would be last year. So that'd be, if the economy was crashing right now, that wouldn't be in the average at all. If it had crashed last year, that'd be one-fifth of the average. So wouldn't necessarily restrict. But to the extent that we'd be running into, you know, the constitutional limit, it's possible that could restrict us. If we're setting the statutory limit close to our current expenditures and then setting a constitutional limit somewhat higher, I would assume that a lot of these expenditures to meet, you know, an economic disaster would be capital spending. They certainly were in 2008 with the American Recovery Act. What states saw was mostly capital spending. That could then be, you know, spent with the two-thirds majority under this this limit. But it's possible that if there were a prolonged, you know, multi-year disaster, yes, this could become problematic to have this restriction, but we would have to have sufficient savings essentially to be able to spend that in the first place. So I guess if you have a multi-year depression, I'm not sure if the spending limit is going to really be what's going to limit your ability to respond. The statutory limit could also be amended by a future legislature. The constitutional would be more difficult and more time, but the statutory one could be amended by a legislature with a simple majority vote of both bodies.
Thank you. Through the chair, one follow-up. So through, let's use Alaska as an example. We had a recession that started in 2015. How long did that one last?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I don't know in terms of the formal definition of a recession, which is, you know, job losses year or quarter over quarter. I'm not sure how long that lasted from a macroeconomic definition.
Okay.
From a fiscal definition, essentially, we had deficits from FY15 through FY21, but that's not really a recession. That's just
okay. And through the chair, follow up is: would you say that Alaska is sensitive to those extremes? That are the averages sensitive?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, we have definitely a more volatile economy than most. It's not necessarily correlated to the U.S. economy, but because of our dependence on particularly one volatile resource, we do have a relatively volatile economy.
Thank you.
Okay. We've got Representative Josephson, Ortiz, and Colon. Representative Josephson.
Chair, either for the sponsor or Mr. Aoudou, could you express the current constitutional limit from, I guess, 1982 as a percent of GDP? Where are we now as a percent of GDP?
Ooh, through the chair to Representative Josephson, that is a very interesting question. I don't know the answer, but I could probably eyeball and look at it. I would imagine it would be 25 or 26%, but I'll defer to the illustrious Director Painter to see if he can do the human brain calculation for me.
Through the chair, Representative Justin, I believe it would be approaching 50% because at the 13% level here, that's $5.8 billion, and the current constitutional limit is about $11.3 billion. So if you double that, that's, you know, about a bit over half, but then bring it back down. So I think it'd be about half, roughly. But I could get back to the committee with a more precise calculation than what I can do without a piece of paper in front of me.
A lot is my answer.
For the sponsor, through the chair, you mentioned a five-year economic downturn. And can you repeat what your thoughts were about such a phenomenon?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Josephson. So the GDP is averaged on a five-year rolling average, basically. So if you had severe downturn in GDP for five consecutive years, you would have a downward pressure on a GDP-based spending limit. So because it's based off an average, that's what I meant by that.
Follow up. As a history teacher and history major, I mean, I'm thinking of 1933 to 38, which was, I think, about 4 years of downturn. Things improved, and then there was something called the Roosevelt Recession, which was in 1937. But his response was a Keynesian approach to prime the pump and get the economy going and to avoid the European experience, which was complete political disruption and upheaval. Now, of course, we're not a country. We're a state. So that sort of drama won't happen in the same way. But given that we're counter-cyclical historically, Representative Galvin talked about, and she's right, that the 07-08 recession was a blip to us. Shouldn't we have, and I say this in particular because we have the strongest governor model under the spending cap, he would grow even, or she, even stronger. I just think factually that's true. So how wouldn't there be circumstances with a five-year economic downturn where our hands are just tied and we're just watching things happen that we could resolve.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Josephson. So my answer to that would be, in the event that you, so the two big differences here, we're talking monetary policy and fiscal policy. At a state level, we control one and not the other. Obviously, monetary policy is controlled at the federal level. So in the event that we had some massive recession, multi-year recession-like event, my argument would be what we would be really limited by is a collapse in all available revenue. Even through taxation, if the state were to implement that, you would see massive out-migration. But my argument is if you're afraid of putting downward pressure, and let's say creating like a self-imposed liquidity crisis. The best way to do that would just be to amend some of the percentages upward to give you more room for a disaster type scenario. I personally am not really worried about that happening, because my belief would be, again, you would have a massive collapse in all revenue, and the spending cap would be the last of your worries in the event of a Great Depression type event in Alaska. So,
hello.
I mean, my concern, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Otto noted the simplicity of just amending the statute that accompanies the Constitution, but we have this strong governor model, and we would need two-thirds support to override a veto. This administration is prone to issuing vetoes. In a crisis, I guess we get those two-thirds votes, but it is a limitation on legislative prerogative. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz, and then Cologne. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. I think my comments are directed to the sponsor, and it's going to be followed with a question here. And I'm going to tie my question to the concerns raised by Representative Hannon by her asking the question about, is there any other state that doesn't have a direct tie between their GDP and revenue in the form of taxes? And you acknowledge that other than Alaska, there isn't. So I guess my question is, wouldn't we be better off suspending this until we resolve the revenue question and let what has continued to work as our spending cap be revenue until that time? Revenue is, in effect, the graph shows, our spending cap. And last year, when we had more revenue, we addressed some issues in the capital budget that were growing deferred maintenance, some capital projects, things like that, which I'm sure helps create some opportunities for economic growth. And it would also let us address our problems with education. You know, when we have more revenue, we can make sure and pay attention to that particular issue, to the BSA and things like that, because I just have a hard time making sense of a spending cap tied to GDP when there's no revenue tied to GDP. There's no revenue for the state tied to GDP, and so it just doesn't seem to make sense to me. So what would you say to that?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Ortiz. First, thanks, off. It's actually a pretty good question, so I appreciate you asking me. So I would say, just from a macro standpoint, I don't know if I'd make the argument the state doesn't have enough revenue. It's more about how we allocate the existing revenues we have, and that's where you're going to get in the policy debate on the dividend versus state spending on government services and stuff like that. The second aspect is, I think the best part about the presentation from Mr. Painter on the historic old existing cap, both the constitutional limit and the statutory limit of the existing appropriation limit the state has have been violated by the legislature on multiple occasions. So my argument would be, just on the mere fact of being good governance and wanting to be accountable to voters alone, that when we have something in our statutes or even in our Constitution that the body has effectively, even unintentionally, violated in the past, we should try to do our due diligence and try to reform that so we can, going forward, we can be accountable and have good governance to our folks, right? So that would be kind of my number one issue. Number two, I would say you can certainly work within the framework of the bill's before the body, to have a tie in terms of what overall percentage of gross domestic product, that would allow for a future conversation of revenue and a future conversation and what the permanent fund dividend should be. And the main aspect of the bill is to try to get long-term thinking and to smooth out the kind of boom and bust cycle that is Alaska's revenue picture. So I would argue that if you go back to the earlier fiscal years, FY12, FY13, and even the revenue spike last year, we probably allocated a lot of money for a lot of good purposes, but I guarantee you everyone would say we probably wasted a bunch of money in those high revenue years that we would have been much more happy if we had decided to sock away for a future purpose. So.
Okay, and we'll take this last question for now. If folks would like, we can come back. Would like to take up HB 21, the University Employee Health Insurance Bill. Just get the introduction before us, and we can come back to this if the committee would like. But we'll go to Representative Colon.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, this might be for Mr. Painter or the sponsor. So in what ways does the current spending cap how is that related to the private sector now? How is that affected? How does the spending cap take into account the private sector right now?
Through the Chair, Representative Colum, so the current spending cap is tied to a fixed number that grows by population and inflation. It does not directly reference the size of the economy in any way.
A follow-up? So right now, we don't have to really respond to what's going on in the private sector as far as our spending, correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Colum, from the spending cap standpoint, right. The spending cap is just, you know, a fixed number of population GDP. Doesn't matter if those people are employed or not. From a revenue standpoint, our revenue comes from private sectors, other than
a follow-up. So how, this probably for the sponsor, so how does this new spending cap fix that? How does the new spending cap make our spending related to what's going on with the private sector?
Representatives, or Mr. Otto?
For the record, Bernard Otto, through the Chair to Representative Colum. So by using state gross domestic product, one of the aspects of gross domestic product are business expenses, business spending, net imports and net exports, which are tied directly to the private sector.
Okay. And one follow-up?
Uh-huh.
So, well, probably just a comment. So, I mean, a lot of extreme examples have been brought up in the committee of what could happen in a, you know, complete disaster of the economy. But our history shows that when we have that revenue, why I think this is great for Alaska, whether we have a tax or not, is because of how we receive revenue. It's volatile. We all know it's volatile. It goes up. It goes way down. And in some of these cases where we've had to put a ton of money into something that we didn't put money into is because we weren't disciplined in those high revenue years. So from my perspective, if you have a high revenue year and it's consistent over time where you're putting money into savings, you're putting money consistently into capital and all these, it takes discipline to do that, and over time, you won't see so much emergencies happening. You would see a more of a stable or stability that if you wanted to increase education, you would have not $1 billion in the higher ed fund. You might have $2 billion. You might be able to draw more. You can put more money in the ERA. It encourages savings. It encourages rainy day finances. It takes, like, when you have that big revenue and you've been starved and you haven't had any discipline, of course we're going to throw it at everything, deferred maintenance and everything we were supposed to be doing, but we didn't. And so I really like the spending cap because it makes the legislature think about the future, not in one session or two sessions, but it says, hey, we're in a high revenue year, and so we're going to put it into savings and those things that we know that in some time when things go down, we have a better financial position to take care of those things and kind of smooth out that emergency spending, whether it's education, retirement, or, you know, whatever, those big deposits that we've done in the past because we weren't doing them before that. So that's all I had.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tomaszewski's got a quick comment, and then we need to go to the next bill, and then we'll come back to this. And I know Representative Galvin's got a question. So with that, Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the Chair. I just want to thank Representative Stapp for this legislation. I think it's exactly what Alaska needs. We need the ability to control spending, and this goes a long way and is a great start to controlling our fiscal policy. And just looking at this chart that we have, you take those mountaintops and you flip them over and you fill the holes, and what do we have? Steady state funding and an ability to not be so dependent on digging into our savings accounts. We do this at in our own lives, I hope, in our own pocketbooks with our own households. I would hope that we would be able to do this in state government. And I really appreciate all the questions to Representative Stapp. There were a lot of good questions, and I'm really thankful in your ability to just go ahead and disperse those questions with a lot of great information. You did a great job there, and I appreciate it. And so I look forward to hearing more about this. So thanks.
Okay, thank you. So with that, if Representative Galvin does not have a question, and if there are no other questions, I was just checking to see if we needed to keep our Mr. Painter here afterwards. But I think we're okay for now. So thank you very much, Mr. Painter. So next we're going to move over to, we've got about half an hour. I think Representative Vance needs to be somewhere at 3 o'clock. So she'll introduce House Bill 21, which is School and University Employee Health Insurance. If you could please come up, as well as your Chief of Staff, Jake Almeida, and put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Representative Sarah Vance for House District 6 of the Lower Kenai Peninsula. I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to hear this bill while you're listening to the financial concerns of the state and how to reduce spending. This bill offers such a solution. It's no secret that school districts are facing challenges recruiting and retaining teachers and support staff, compounded by the rising cost of health care. As a representative and wife of an elementary school custodian, I hear you. This fall, I attended my local school board meeting where I heard the teacher representative for health insurance plead with the school board members to have an emergency meeting to discuss what they could do to help retain teachers due to the increased cost of health care premiums for families. It was at that moment that I recommended the introduction of HB 21, the school healthcare consolidation, as an option for the school district to pursue should it be the will of the legislature to support and pass this concept. The bill has been offered and heard in prior legislatures, but only as a requirement that all school districts consolidate. This bill is distinctly different in that it supports local control and is 100% optional for schools. According to the 2019 ICER research summary, number 2019-4, titled How Much Does Alaska Spend on K-12 Schools, subsection What Drives the Cost of Public Education in Alaska, it states three Alaska exceptionalities set us apart from other states in our education spending patterns: small schools, healthcare, and energy. Alaska has the highest per capita healthcare cost in the U.S., which negatively affects private and public sectors of our economy. Healthcare costs are a part of teacher compensation, and I'm quoting from that report. While the challenge of high healthcare costs is not unique to education, in a fixed budget scenario, these costs put downward pressure on wages, making it more difficult for Alaska districts to offer teachers a nationally competitive salary. My goal is to ease the financial burden of school districts and give the state of Alaska more leverage to negotiate with healthcare providers, improving services for Alaskans, with the potential of saving millions of dollars. House Bill 21 amends current statute to provide the option for school districts, the University of Alaska, and governmental units such as cities and boroughs to participate in AlaskaCare, the state employee healthcare program. These entities would have the choice to opt into the pool as an entire entity, enabling Alaska's Department of Administration to negotiate a better cost of healthcare. So we ask, what are the benefits of consolidation? Number one is that it saves money. By expanding the number of participants in a healthcare pool, the potential for savings increases. Most of our school districts are small and must carry the burden alone. Several school districts have responded favorably and have reported potential savings of $7 million a year. My school district has reported that if all of the participants chose to be included, it would be potentially savings of $6 million a year. Our current deficit is about $4.4 million in our school district after use of COVID funds. So they have the potential of closing their budget gap and providing for better health care. They've had a challenge in the market because there's a few high users. And this would provide not only provide them great budget savings, but it would also provide them an excellent health care plan. The Massu School District has said that if all of their employees and their bargaining units were to consolidate, they could potentially save $7 million. That's about a $3,000 per employee savings to them, which equates to about a 125% increase in the BSA. Previous estimates concluded a savings of at least $200 million per year if all school districts chose to consolidate healthcare under one plan. While the amount of savings is determined by the number of participants, healthcare consolidation is an option worth pursuing. It also provides more healthcare options. Some school districts, like mine, are facing challenges shopping the market to find affordable healthcare due to high-use members. This bill expands options with a larger pool to more easily offset high use. And the additional indirect benefit is that it reduces staff burden. Schools who choose to consolidate will reduce the staff burden of having a dedicated employee responsible for the healthcare plan. This flexibility will free up staff to focus on what matters most, and that's providing a quality education for our children. The option of consolidation is intended to help reduce the cost of education, but also available to the University of Alaska, our local municipalities and boroughs, and each government unit can find a healthcare plan that fits their individual needs and budget by working together. And I also have included a sectional analysis, should the co-chairs will, for me to go over that now.
Was that, you said the sectional, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I think that was fairly short. Please do that. Or actually, two pages, but we can, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I will not read the entire sectional.
Thank you.
Every member has likely done their homework, but I will provide some highlights. So the one change that was added through in the House Labor and Commerce Committee is Section 9 that authorizes the Department of Administration to investigate the potential cost of any interested school district, local government, or university, and report back to the legislature prior to the commissioner approving their admission into the AlaskaCare. This is to do an actuarial and analysis to see if it would be beneficial to the plan or not. So if we go back to the beginning, there's a couple of sections of interest. Section 3 allows the Commissioner of Administration to expend from the Public Health Education Fund to the AlaskaCare Group Health and Life Benefits Fund as needed to pay claims submitted by school employees who are provided a policy of self-insurance that just provides for an accounting mechanism. And this one we can touch on later, but this has been a particular topic of interest, and I will defer to the will of the committee on the details of that. Sections 4 through 6 are the meat of the bill. Section 4 adds the ability for school districts and the University of Alaska and then the governmental units in Section 6 to be a part of the our healthcare plan. The other sections are specifically giving the Board of Regents under the university and the REAs the legislative authority to add themselves to optionally participate should they choose so. Section 10 authorizes the Department of Administration to provide medical coverage to school district employees and government units by means of self-insurance. This means that they, if it is not beneficial for a particular unit to opt into the entire pool, that the Department of Administration can look if it's more beneficial for them to have a policy of self-insurance. So it's not a one or nothing. There are options available depending on the cost and the health care provided. Section 12 highlights that the bill is applicable to collective bargaining agreements and other contracts that become legally binding. Section 13 requires self-insured school districts to transfer the closing balance of their self-funded insurance reserve account soon after they enroll to apply to be offset of the reimbursements. Section 14 is a time of adopting regulations necessary, and this is an important component of the bill, that the bill will not automatically go into effect. It gives a one-year transition period to adopt regulations, and I think this is a wonderful time for the Department of Administration to find who's interested in consolidating under our group health insurance. And this allows them the time to see what the cost and the benefits are and just the burden of employees that would be needed in the Department of Administration for further analysis. So that that's the highlight of the sectional analysis, and we do have available from the Department of Administration the Division of Retirement and Benefits Director and the Health Program Manager for members' questions.
Great. Perfect summary of the sectional. Thank you. I like the highlights there. We've got a couple questions. I think I saw three hands, Representative Stapp, Hannon, Ortiz, and Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to the bill sponsor, or perhaps the folks from Retirement and Benefits Online. So I want to thank Representative Vance for kind of bringing this forward. I think healthcare costs, as we have talked about in the BSA bill, are one of the leading drivers in education costs in the state. So I have a plethora of questions. My first question is going to be regarding actuarial analysis of the impact to AlaskaCare. So from an insurance perspective, my argument would be what you would be highly likely to see would be all the kind of really high-risk small groups would flow into the AlaskaCare plan, and you probably wouldn't be likely to get the larger kind of entities, say the Anchorage School District or the Fairbanks School District or the Matthews School District, consolidating because of the nature of costs. So the last time that the state really looked at this plan was in 2014. They commissioned the Hay Group to do the study. And I tend to think it's probably a good time to look at that again because it's been about 8 or 9 years. But I'm curious if the folks from either the bill sponsor or the folks from Retirement Benefits kind of want to comment on the potential influx in a kind of a higher population risk pool kind of driving up the associated cost for the AlaskaCare plan.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, we have spoken with the department and they were not planning on doing any actuarial until the bill reached finance, but we do have them available for more direct questions.
Julie.
Yeah, I'll summarize my question. I just to simplify it, just thoughts on overall impact and kind of rushing to, let's say, your high-risk folks kind of stacking into your AlaskaCare plan and driving up your costs.
Okay, and so we've got two folks online. A.J. Desai and Andrea Morcha, if you can both put yourselves on the record, state your name and your positions.
Yes, this is A.J. Desai, Division Director for Retirement and Benefits. As you just heard, we have not done any actuarial analysis yet. It's too early in the stage. Without this bill being finalized, we have only determined initial operational cost based on the initial analysis of this bill, which was submitted.
Representative Stapp?
Early.
Yeah, I guess my follow-up would be, maybe to the co-chair, what's kind of the method to do an actuarial analysis? I mean, my personal opinion would be that's kind of a key ingredient of the viability of the long-term impact of the bill. So how would we go about doing that?
Mr. Desai, at what point, I realize that normally this is something that can only be done at the finance level. I do know that. Is it when it becomes imminent that the bill is going to pass out and that's by request of the co-chairs, or what would be the normal process that you would expect?
Through the chair, let me invite Andrea Moika if she can answer that question. Well, Andrea, would you be able to elaborate a bit on this?
And can you put yourself on the record also?
Yes, good afternoon. Through the chair, this is Andrea Moika. I'm the Health Operations Manager for Alaska here. And for the actuarial analysis, we were planning to come up with three scenarios, one that kind of showed the cost impacts, either neutral or cost that it would drive up the cost of electric care, and one that it would reduce. Because depending on who joins the Alaska Care Plan, we don't know if it will actually save money or if it will cost us money or if it will be neutral. And so we can get some updated analysis probably within about 3 weeks.
Okay, thank you. And maybe if I could just ask while you're online, I think part of the reason for I guess this being kind of an extraordinary thing is the cost of the actuarial analysis is maybe a little more substantial than folks might think. And can you tell us about what the range might be on that?
Yes, through the chair, this is Andrea Morga. We have gotten a quote that it will be around $30,000 for this request.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stapp?
Yeah, through the chair, so I have a little bit of knowledge here in history. I know that the Hay study that was commissioned by the Senate in 2014 was about $200,000. I want to say that was the cost of the study. So are we sure that you can do effectively the same thing that they did for $30,000 and 8 years later? Or?
Through the chair, this is Andrea Moika. And I'm not familiar with that 2014 study, so I will have to look through that to see if we can have that updated. I think we could potentially do a quicker turnaround if we have a template from scratch that we could pull up some current information. But again, I'd have to look at what was provided in the past.
I thought I saw an email just recently that somewhere in the range of 150 to 200,000 is what I thought I saw. But we do have questions. I just wanted to make sure I wanted to see if Representative Vance had any comments on the actuarial before we go to additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is simply the will of the Finance Committee on the progress for this and to consider this policy and the potential savings and benefit for providing health care to our school districts.
Okay, thank you. We've got Representative Hannon, Ortiz and Galvin. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Representative Vance, there are two districts represented in the packet of support that you gave us, multiple letters, but only two school districts, 53 school districts. Many school districts have more than one insurance plan because they have different bargaining units represented by different folks. So I'm wondering whether you've had direct communications from other school districts about their interest and support for doing it. And I guess philosophically, I am a huge fan of universal health care. And so the more people we put into plan, the better towards that goal that I see. But I also served on my health plan's trust and know teachers typically are fairly expensive to insure because they're young, they're female, they're having babies. It's kind of the most expensive, you know, the two most expensive insurance time is those young health years when you're having children and then when you're old and needing the replacement parts. And so you're trying to get them out the door into that retiree plan before the replacement parts are coming on your health budget. So I'm wondering if you've heard from 51 other districts, and whether they've looked at their own and said, we want in because I got 20 babies happening out of 40 employees, and there's no way that we're going to be able to keep our health coverage. It's going to skyrocket at this rate of participation. So looking to see if you've had communications from districts about their interest in joining and whether, if it is more expensive for them, whether they'll be kicked out.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we have emailed all of the school districts and sent out the communication with the documents asking for their interest and their input. We've heard back from Ketchikan, from the Ketchikan Borough, Kenai Peninsula Borough, and the Mat-Su, and some of the other smaller communities. But the overall, out of the large number, has been quiet, and we're not sure if it's something that they are still deliberating. But the Mat-Su and the Kenai Peninsula are some of the larger school districts who are definitely saying that they want this option to see if it will work, because the potential for savings is definitely something to look at.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Ms. Vance, we don't have the letter. You've indicated support from the Mat-Su Borough, and I'm wondering if you could share that support. We do have, and of course, the Ketchikan Borough and the Ketchikan Gate, you know, that's one school district. So whether you could give us the support from the Mat-Su and whether they have more than one unit represented in the healthcare plan. I don't know if they're certified staff and they're non-certified or one. I think in Kenai, they're one unified plan.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes, we can get that to you. If I recollect, the Mat-Su, I believe, has four different bargaining units. And, of course, it's a conversation to see if some of them, all of them, want to join in. But what I anticipate is that each school district, each unit, whether it's a small municipality or a school, will come to the Department of Administration, and they will have that conversation about what their needs are and say, what's the option? Will this save us and provide the same quality of health care, or should we stick to the plan that we have? And we just have to get to that point where we can have that conversation.
Thank you.
Okay. Also, I just want to note that we also have Ken Truitt online, legislative liaison for Department of Administration. And Mr. Truitt, can you comment on the actuarial analysis? And then, Representative Vance, anytime you need to leave, just give me the nod and we can come back to this later. So I know you've got some time constraints. But, Mr. Truitt, if you can put yourself on the record.
Yes, for the record, this is Ken Truitt, legislative liaison for the Department of Administration. Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes, thanks. Thank you for that question. I think, as to the process question, for this type of legislation, the Department of Administration would begin an actuarial study to be a part of a fiscal note when it is requested by the Finance Committee, either committee as a whole or the co-chair's office. We would, either of those, we would start the work at that point, but not until it's been requested of the Finance Committee.
Okay, and in terms of cost, can you address that?
Through the chair, for the record, this is Ken Truitt, Department of Administration Legislative Liaison. We're thinking, and Director Desai can correct me if I'm wrong, that for this particular bill, the way that it's currently written, because of other reports that a prior speaker referred to, the cost would be estimated to be around $30,000.
Okay, thank you. So with that, we do have two questions from Representative Ortiz and Representative Galvin, but Representative Vance, I don't know if you wanted your chief of staff, who was just here a second ago. I don't know. We can always come back to this later if you need to take off. For now, do you have preference?
Foster, my chief of staff is informing my committee we are delayed to the call of the
chair. Oh, okay, perfect. So if that's okay with you, we'll go to Representative Ortiz then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I think my question is maybe for the Department of Administration. So my question is, so what did go into determining the fiscal note that's before us? It, projects out about $350 million a year. I think I'm reading that the right way. It falls off down towards the end to 327. So how was that particular fiscal note put together without, yeah, what went into it?
Mr. Truitt?
Through the chair and for the record, this is Ken Truitt, Department of Administration Legislative Liaison. This is one that I think is going to be best answered by Andrea Mweka, who works in the health division of the Division of Retirement Benefits, and they would be the unit that would be implementing this bill if it were to pass.
Ms. Mweka?
Hi, through the chair, this is Andrea Mweka. And I'll have to look at the fiscal note impact. I believe that was pushed out some years, and it had to do with our requirements for staffing. We need at least, I believe, 3 full-time employees for this. We also need actuarial analysis and some legal counsel as well so that we can get things planned out for regulations. But yes, those are how we came to the cost analysis.
Yeah, I'll correct myself, $350,000, not $350 million.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Galvin.
Thank you. The concept is absolutely, this could be a game changer for education. So I look forward to hearing my questions actually were similar to Representative Hannon's. I wanted to find out how many districts had jumped in. So I'm anxious to hear that and also to learn maybe more about how we come together. Maybe we need some leadership opportunities where we can learn as a state if we did agree to something as big as this and it's as a large number of districts, how we would be helping each other in the overall picture. So I hope that we can explore this more. I look forward to the actuarial, and I think that this is going to be one of the pieces that's going to get us to supporting our children a lot more than we are. So thank you very much.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair to folks at, I guess, retirement and benefits, just out of curiosity, what is the current per employee per year cost of last care?
Through the chair, this is Andrea Mweka. And our current contributions, I'm so sorry, can you please repeat your question?
Yeah, the PEPY, the current per employee per year cost of AlaskaCare.
Sure, thank you, through the chair. Currently, the numbers I have off the top of my head is the average per employee per month is around $1,734. So I'd have to grab my calculator really quick to get you the annualized.
I got it. It's $20,000.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Coach. Hello. So, you know, the reason I bring that up is because I referenced the Hay Group study. This is out of date, so the numbers are going to be higher. But from my recollection, it was $18,446 per year, per employee per year cost. So Alaska Care, you're saying, is $20,808. So, again, we're looking to realize savings. My thought is certainly some school districts are going to want to do this to save, but it would, without kind of going through each individual district and calculating the per employee per year cost, we're not, like, we don't want to effectively drive the cost of AlaskaCare up by only having the, let's call it, highest districts kind of jump into the pool. That'll overall dilute the pool. So I'm curious if you guys know or have anything updated from 2014 regarding that, or we have to lump that in the actuarials too, because I'm still not, and I hate to be like skeptical, but I don't see how you can achieve that under $30,000, but I'm wondering if you could speak to that. So,
Ms. Mweka?
Through the chair, this is Andrea Mweka, and yes, I believe we already have a starting point, which is why our actuarial group, we work through Siegel Consulting. They have quoted us the $30,000 to be able to do the analysis for the school district to come in as this is written today. So if there is additional information that you would want to know that we're going to add to this, it could incur more cost for that analysis as well.
Just a quick follow-up, Co-Chair Foster. Thank you. Is it possible maybe if I could get just a list of the information that you're going to be trying to figure out? So in the event that we need to add anything, I can maybe ask the co-chairs. Because my thought would be the other aspect that you want to look at is you want to look at effectively what the employee-employer cost share is, what the deductibles in the existing plan is, et cetera. And those are all going to factor in kind of the cost. So.
Through the chair, this is Andrea Moika. Absolutely, we can follow up with that request afterwards.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'll take two more questions, Representative Cologne and Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, I think this is probably for the bill sponsor. I didn't see in here, but I assume the university supports this, and what is their role, and how do they feel about all this, since they would be a big part of the drive to move forward with this?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne, the university is neutral on this. Adding them to the plan is not needed at this time, so they have just remained neutral. It works for them either way. And to that point, 4 years ago when I first introduced this bill, my school district of the Kenai Peninsula Borough did not need it at the time. Everything was great, had wonderful insurance. In fact, I was on that insurance since my husband works for the school district. And they said, no, we're not interested. And I said, okay, I won't pursue the bill any further if I can't get local support for it. However, fast forward 4 years, and they are desperately needing it. And so that speaks to the importance of having options for the future, because as healthcare has dramatically risen and things change, that some of these schools or options, municipalities may need that option available to them, and it's just a matter of having that conversation with the Department of Administration.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
So with that, the Department of Administration, I was just trying to get clarity. It had something to do with in the sectional that they help analyze whether, I guess my question is, will DOA help these little school districts help them know if it's a good idea to join the plan or not, or is that kind of on the individual district?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne, Section 9 that was added in Labor and Commerce does address that. It's a requirement that before the commissioner authorizes acceptance of one of these units is that they will do a report of what the potential costs are.
And one more follow-up.
Follow-up.
So if I understand what you said before, this bill was offered and there was a mandatory participation. Was that driven kind of by what Representative Staff was saying, is that if you make it voluntary, you tend to overwhelm the policy with more high-needs people? Or do you think, I guess, what's your feeling about it not being mandatory as opposed to mandatory?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne, I was not paying attention to politics in 2014. The conversations that I know took place was that local school districts wanted to retain their local control. They opposed the idea of being forced to consolidate when they didn't feel that it could be in their best interest. It was also, for that reason, it was also opposed by NEA.
Oh, okay. And just a quick follow-up.
Comment.
I like that it's voluntary. I mean, we've had school districts, I think it was Fairbanks, that said that they would rather not do that. Their costs are good. So I think it's positive in terms of local control. I guess we'll have to see the actuarial to see if it will affect the policy part, the money part. But thank you so much for bringing it forward.
Okay. And final question, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to, first of all, ask if you would please have the information that was noted to be handed out to all the committee members. I think the representative staff would ask for some information, but if we could all get that, would be good. But secondly, I was wondering, do you know how many districts have like a blind health care trust? I mean, my understanding is Matsu does not, we do not know what our health care costs are.
Co-Chair Johnson, I do not know that answer. The Mat-Su School District is one who has given great support for this because it could potentially save $7 million a year. Mm-hmm. And they were the first one to reach out to us saying, please move this bill, because not only is it downward pressure on the education budget, but resulting in what they've estimated $3,000 per employee savings out of their paycheck. But I don't know the details of the school district's plan.
Thank you. And follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that this is something that just needs to be examined and has good potential. And I know that Matt, I'm not sure of all the details with it, but some of the contracts, more than others, have different types of healthcare transparency. So if there was any chance that this would increase the transparency, that would be tremendous. Thank you.
Okay. Any closing comments, Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair Foster. I would like to note for the committee that we did include the Alaska Care 2023 Active Employees Premiums Chart as provided by the Department of Administration for looking at what the current costs are of the question that was raised by Representative Stapp. And just wanted to highlight that this is I am no healthcare expert by any means, but I am just offering this policy idea as a tool for us to examine as we're looking at ways to reduce costs and make the most of our dollars and provide for great health care to not only our state employees, but to our schools and other governmental units. In looking at the overall education budget, we indirectly pay for health care in one form or another through the BSA. And so this is something that I will leave up to the will of the committee on who all should be included. My goal is that we treat all school districts on equal footing, because there are some who are rather small and they need the help of a larger pool. And there's some who are larger who may be doing fine, just as Rep. Colomb mentioned, that Fairbanks says, hey, we're doing great right now. And this bill is meant to look to the future in a way that we can be supportive of each other, of killing two birds with one stone. We're easing the education budget to make our dollars go farther, but also helping recruit and retain teachers by providing great health care. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Representative Vance and Mr. Almeida. And with that, we're going to take a very quick 2-minute coffee break to stretch our legs, and we'll come back to our next bill, which is House Bill 112, Profession of Pharmacy. So with that, break it ease. Okay, we'll call House Finance back to order at 3:16 p.m. And I'd like to invite up to the table Representative Ruffridge and his staff, Bud Sexton, to come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and introduce your bill. We've also got online a presentation from Dr. Ashley Shaver, Chair of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy. And before us is House Bill 112, which is Profession of Pharmacy. So with that, if you'd like to first put yourself on the record, and if you've got any opening comments, we'll take those. If not, we'll go straight to the presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Justin Ruffridge. I am the representative for District 7, which is Kenai and Soldotna area. Joining me is not Bud Sexton, it's Braden Garrett, one of my staff members who can provide some context if needed and desired by the committee. House Bill 112 is a bill dealing with the profession of pharmacy, and I will be as brief as possible because Dr. Shaver will be online and go through the presentation, so I will try not to steal her thunder. But this process of coming forward with these statute changes is a multi-year, multi-chair of the Board of Pharmacy process. We were tasked with regulation changes by the administration to go through as a board the different regulations for our profession, make changes to have what was called the right touch, so right touch regulation changes, modernizing our profession as the profession has changed quite a bit over the last 25 to 30 years. During that process, the board, which was the chair that was before myself, then myself, and then the current chair of the Board of Pharmacy, started keeping a list of the number of things that would need statute changes in order to have those right touch regulations be produced. And so this bill is a collection of those statute changes to help modernize our profession, as well as give the board the authority to continue that and finish that regulatory process. So certainly happy to answer any of your questions, but in the interest of time, I know if you'd like to, Mr. Chair, have Dr. Shaver give her presentation, and then I can be available at the end of that.
Okay, sounds very good. We'll do that. Ms. Shaver, if you're online, can you state your name, your affiliation, and proceed with the presentation?
Yes, good afternoon, Co-Chair Foster and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ashley Shaver. I'm chair of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy, and I am speaking to you today on behalf of the Board of Pharmacy. I have been a practicing pharmacist in Alaska for almost 16 years, and I practice in Anchorage. And if you're looking at the slides, that will take you to my next slide, which will show you the Alaska Board of Pharmacy strategic plan. And as Representative Ruffridge mentioned, this has been a cumulative effort over the last several years. And really what we are trying to do is ensure that the Board of Pharmacy has statute changes in place to ensure it can meet its mission of promoting, preserving, and protecting public health, safety, and welfare by and through the effective control and regulation of the practice of pharmacy. And on our strategic plan, goal number 4 is to grow the economy while promoting community health and safety. So many of the changes in the board relate to goal number 4, specifically 4.1, which is to routinely review effectiveness of regulations that reduce barriers to licensure without compromising public health and safety. 4.4, to advocate for legislation as the pharmacy profession evolves and new opportunities for patient safety arise. And 4.5, to anticipate changes to the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act and respond proactively. I also want to take a moment on this slide and talk a little bit about the composition of the board. Currently, our board has 7 members. 5 of those members are pharmacists, and 2 of those members are public members. Next slide, please. House Bill 112 addresses changes needed really by putting those into 4 different pillars: streamlining the licensure process while improving public safety, compliance with the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act, alignment with other professional boards, both in Alaska and other pharmacy boards in other states, and then clarification of pharmacists' roles in critical medication access, and this includes epinephrine and also critical dialysate fluid access. This is a collaborative effort. It's been a collaborative effort not only with multiple boards of pharmacy, but also with the Alaska Pharmacists Association. And both of those do support this bill. Next slide, please. So the first goal is to streamline the licensure process while improving public safety. This bill eliminates unnecessary forms that are currently required in statute. These are redundant forms. The information in the forms is part of the licensure process. And so by eliminating these forms, it reduces the burden both on the licensed applicant and on the division processing those. There's another change that clarifies that only pharmacists who dispense controlled substances are required to register with the prescription drug monitoring program. And then the other change here to improve public safety is to add a national criminal background check. Currently, pharmacists and pharmacy technicians are only required to have a state-level background check, and the board over the last several years has realized that adding a national criminal background check adds an additional level of protection. Pharmacists and pharmacy technicians regularly handle controlled substances, and so the board felt that having that national criminal background check in place would be an added level of safety for Alaskans. Currently, we rely on other states, license action in other states, and also word of the applicant. This background check is required in 30 other states. It is in statute as a requirement for nursing and other professions here in Alaska as well.
Ms. Saper, I've got a question from Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair yes. Foster. Excuse me for forgetting your name. Ms. Shaber, do you know what that national background check looks like when it comes to you? Does that report detail what they found or just that it shows that the pharmacist just had a criminal violation?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I do not know the details in what that national background level check process would look like and what's found. I know it would serve as a flag to prompt additional review. I do know that Director Sylvan Robb is available. I believe she's available, and she might be able to speak to that as well.
Thank you.
Response from Representative Ruffridge.
Yes, thank you, Chair Foster. Through the Chair, Representative Hannon. So the application for a licensure currently has a self-selection response. So It indicates on the application, yes or no, have you been convicted of or are you currently under an investigation for? One of those questions is in regards to criminal behavior. Currently, you can check that box, no, and the answer is actually yes, and there's not a follow-up on that. In my time on the board, although short, there was at least one example of that being the case where the box was checked as no, and the answer to that was yes. And there was an issue came to light through the investigation process, and it was unfortunate because there was a situation that should have been caught with a criminal violation in Florida that criminal violation then happened in Alaska as well. And so a lot of that request to have the background check is to essentially say, when you check that box on your application, did you tell us the truth, yes or no? If someone checks no and the answer is yes, then that is a reason to deny them a license.
Well, thank you, Chair Foster, and I guess I'll just bring the sponsor up to date on my thinking, because last week we spent a lot of hours talking about background checks for cannabis convictions that are no longer convictions under Alaska law and how we're going to change those background records, and sort of there's a pool of historical records that have to be hand-searched, et cetera. And you know, I could see us getting to the point where we're going to potentially have a pharmacist applicant who has a conviction in another state that still has cannabis convictions for possession at age 20 as a crime, yet we don't consider it a crime. And so I'm hoping that it's not just a yes or no, you're disqualified. You know, we'd want people to honestly answer and disclose, but it's not necessarily an automatic denial. But I don't actually know whether whether federal law governs pharmacists so tightly that the board process would allow that to be taken into account.
Representative Ruffage?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Hannon. Marijuana is still considered a federal controlled substance in Class 1, i.e. it is an illicit substance. And because the pharmacy world is governed by the DEA, particularly in regards to most substances that you dispense that are of a controlled nature, a violation that would be with a controlled drug of any type, regardless of whether it was marijuana or not, would most certainly be a flag for any person that would be in connection to or dispensing another controlled substance. And so, yes, that would most certainly be something that would be of great interest to the board before approving a license, particularly because that person still chose to engage in a crime, and that crime was of nature with a controlled substance, regardless of whether or not the state of Alaska deemed it to not be one. We still go through significant conversation in regards to hiring as well in this state. If you have a conviction with marijuana and you are going to be accessing controlled substances, it still is of great interest to the DEA and as such great interest to the Board of Pharmacy.
Thank you.
Good, thank you. Representative Cologne?
Just real quick, can we have Representative Ruffage put his credentials on the record since he's speaking to the bill?
Representative Ruffage?
Credentials as in my pharmacy. Healthcare credentials?
Those things related to pharmacy.
Oh, sure, yeah. So I am the previous Board of Pharmacy Chair. I am a licensed pharmacist in the state of Alaska, have been since 2008. When I graduated from Washington State University, go Wazoo Cougs, sorry, Representative Ortiz, and with a Doctor of Pharmacy degree.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Saber, if you could please continue with the presentation.
Sure. For the record, this is Ashley Saber, Chair of the Board of Pharmacy. Let's move on to the next slide, which is titled Compliance with the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act. So the Federal Drug Supply Chain and Security Act further secures the U.S. drug supply through a system to prevent harmful drugs from entering the supply chain, detect harmful drugs if they do enter our supply chain, and enable rapid response when such drugs are found. And as the Board of Pharmacy has learned more about this federal act, we realized how important of a role that the Board of Pharmacy plays in this process. And that's through the appropriate licensing of drug distributors and pharmacies. And so House Bill 112 ensures that the Alaska Board of Pharmacy powers and duties support the Drug Supply Chain and Security Act related to manufacturers, out-of-state pharmacies, and internet pharmacies. So it provides clarification that out-of-state pharmacies and including internet pharmacies need to be licensed to ensure that Alaskans receive safe medication. This is a modernization. Currently in statute, the out-of-state pharmacies are required to register. This is a statute that was put in place in 1992, and there's been much change with our drug supply chain and the profession of pharmacy and pharmacy in general since 1992. So this gives the Board of Pharmacy jurisdiction over out-of-state pharmacies. This was brought up several times over the last couple years that I've been on the board in the form of public comment, concern that out-of-state pharmacies that are potentially mailing prescriptions into the state may not be providing the same level of service, including counseling, that our in-state pharmacies are required to in statute and regulation provide. And that takes us to our next slide. which is titled Alignment. So the bill replaces one of the two public member seats with a pharmacy technician seat. This is in alignment with 14 other states. And as the practice of pharmacy has evolved, the role of pharmacy technicians has evolved in the practice of pharmacy. And we feel that it's important to have a pharmacy technician represented on the board to bring the pharmacy technician perspective. Additionally, up until about a month ago, both of our public member seats have been vacant for about a year. So this allows a pharmacy technician to serve on the board, and we hope that that will help fill the vacancy issue as well. The next change is to allow the board to adopt language for retirement pharmacist status. So this aligns our board with other states. It also aligns our board with other professional boards in the state. The medical board, the nursing board, and the chiropractic board, for example, all allow retired licensees to retire their license versus simply letting it lapse. And then the last change here is to clarify that the board executive administrator's salary, this allows flexibility for a pharmacist to serve in the role in the future. So currently, the salary is spelled out in statute, and it is limiting. So we realized during our recent board executive administrator transition, we realized that there's no the salary is not flexible enough to allow a pharmacist to apply and be hired into that position. So we wanted that flexibility in the future. We did not want to require a pharmacist in the position because we recognized that applicants with other credentials can serve in the role just as well, but we wanted to ensure that we have that possibility in the future. As the pharmacy profession has become more and more complex, this is becoming more and more common. More than 50% of other states either require or have a professional pharmacist in their executive role. And that takes us to our next slide, which is entitled Epinephrine Access. So one of the changes in the bill is to move the epinephrine training program that is currently under the Department of Health to move that to be under the Board of Pharmacy Oversight. The changes also clarify that a pharmacist can administer epinephrine to a person or prescribe an epinephrine auto-injector to someone who has completed the training program. Ultimately, this increases epinephrine access for Alaskans who have both known anaphylaxis and those who might not know that they have anaphylaxis. This is particularly important in our rural areas. And I also want to add on this slide, in terms of access, that some of the changes in this bill also increase access by decreasing barriers to dialysis fluids. This is also important for our Alaskans who live in rural areas and who are on home dialysis by allowing patients to receive this life-saving treatment at home. And that takes us to the last slide. On behalf of the Board of Pharmacy, we appreciate your time today, and we respectfully request your support for House Bill 112, allowing us to further promote, preserve, and protect public health, safety, and welfare of Alaskans by and through the effective control and regulation of the practice. And I thank you for your time today.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Haber, epinephrine, that's used for things like somebody gets a bee sting or they're allergic to shellfish and they have their throat starts to close up. Just want to put that out there. Is that, am I missing something there? Is that, if you could just describe epinephrine.
Yes, epinephrine is an emergency medication that is used for allergic reactions. So it could be an allergic reaction to bee sting. It could be eggs. It could be peanuts. Sometimes people know that they have anaphylaxis, and other times they don't know until they're exposed to the substance that causes the reaction.
Great. Thank you. Questions on the bill? Representative Hammond?
Thank you, Chair Foster. I think my question is for Ms. Robb from the division, and it has to do with the board executive administrator's salary. And it's in Section 10 of the bill, that it's one, if you have a pharmacist license, then the executive administrator is entitled to a monthly salary based on the salary classification for pharmacists. So first, I guess for Ms. Robb, I want to know, how many of our medical or professional boards have similar? So does the nursing board say, if you have an executive administrator who is an RN, that they're paid on our RN schedule versus range 23, and whether we do have a salary classification for pharmacists pay schedule in the state pay schedules?
And Ms. Robb, if you can put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Through the Chair to Representative Hannon, there are other pharmacists who work for the state, so that is a profession for which we have pay, and it ranges depending upon the duties. There's a pharmacist employed at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute as well as in the Department of Health for Medicaid, and those positions range from range 24 to range 27. In regard to your other question relating to the executive administrators for the other boards, there are six of our 21 professional licensing boards that have an executive administrator position. One more board has a similar position with a different title. And only one, the Board of Nursing, requires qualifications. So the Board of Nursing executive administrator is required to be an RN, and they actually are required to have a master's degree in nursing. But otherwise, it's just looking for someone who has the competencies to be that executive administrator for the board.
So thank you, Chair Foster. So, Ms. Robb, in the nursing board, are they paid on the nurse's scout schedule then? Where are they paid? Is there statute governing like this, say, this range, or does it say pay at the RN nursing range schedule?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, they are not paid as a nurse, so the executive administrator positions are in the partially exempt service. The salary for the executive administrator of the Board of Nursing is not specified in statute, but because it does have a requirement that the person be a licensed professional as well as have a master's degree, that is our highest paid among the executive administrator positions, and it's a range 25.
Okay. One more follow-up. I'm going to try one more time. So the competencies of being the executive administrator of the nursing boards require them to have a nursing background, but not a license. But that's not referenced in their pay schedule at all. So they're paid, all of them, including this position, are exempt positions, which generally mean they're paid higher than the, you know, clerk typist, because there is an expertise and professional background requirement. I'm just trying to figure out if this phrasing for the pharmacy board administrator is a unique and special carve out just for pharmacy, and we don't see it anywhere else or in our other medical boards that would have similar required competencies to be the executive administrator, whether we're compensating them adequately also.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I think I understand what you're asking. So, as I mentioned, for one thing, not all of our healthcare boards have an executive administrator. Obviously, the Board of Nursing, the Medical Board, but for instance, dental, chiropractors, those boards do not have executive administrators. For those that are, nursing is the only one that does have a requirement that the person be a member of that profession. They are required to be a licensed nurse as well as have a master's degree in nursing. And so the pay ranges for those executive administrator positions, depending on the workload and whether it's in statute. Half of them are specified in statute what the pay range will be. So in this case, the position is currently filled not by a pharmacist, and the board is looking to have the ability that if they wanted to hire a pharmacist, they would actually be able to attract someone because they would be able to pay that individual at the going rate for a pharmacist. Did I get it this time?
Pretty darn close. Could you
follow?
Chair Foster, thank you. Ms. Robb, do you know what that range increase would be for us to pay the pharmacy executive administrator as a pharmacist as opposed to a range 23? Do you know what range we'd put them at?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. So the other pharmacists that work for the state now are, depending upon their duties, are range 24 to range 27. And so we would have to work with classification to see which one of those positions they felt this was most similar to.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Foster.
Okay, Representative Josephson.
Mr. Chair, I only want to ask some questions in this area if our time permits.
Yes, go ahead.
Because they're more sort of educational for me, and I've got the director here, but I'll be fast. I'm just curious, you mentioned there's six of the boards that have their own executive administrator. Do the licensees pay for that position?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the licensees do. So the division is funded through receipt-supported services and the cost of the staff that staff the program, whether they are executive administrators or occupational licensing examiners or other staff, the supervisors for the occupational licensing examiners, all of those positions are paid for by the licensees for that profession. So we do timekeeping to so staff can account for which program they're working on and so that those charges are allocated appropriately.
Okay, follow up. I guess my curiosity is just these six boards, they're doing this out of the kindness of their heart, right? I mean, and in this case, their wallet. I'm just curious. I wasn't aware that some of them have an executive administrator. I knew that the state medical board did. And if they chose not to, then the state would pick up some extra costs?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, all of the costs, regardless of whether the staff working on that licensing program and with that board are paid for by the licensees of the program. So it doesn't matter if they have an executive administrator or not. The staff that work on the program are paid for through the license fees.
Last follow-up. I guess what I'm wondering then is why everyone wouldn't want to have their own executive administrator, based on what you just said.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. It depends on the scope of the program, the complexity of it. So, for example, the Board of Nursing oversees 28,000 licensees, and there are 10 people who are part of that team. And so having an executive administrator makes a lot of sense so that we have staff who are dedicated to that. Obviously, for the State Medical Board, again, there's a lot of complexity to those licensing. The same with the profession of pharmacy, because there's a lot of complexity in the licensing. Some of the programs either don't have the degree of complexity or the number of licensees where the expense would be felt more by the licensees, and it's just not needed.
Thank you for that.
Senator Clone.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, this might be, I don't know, maybe to the sponsor, maybe to Dr. Schaefer. So I was really interested in the change to the out-of-state pharmacy. So what I understood was right now they have to be registered, but they don't have to be licensed. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, that is correct.
So with this bill, they would have to be licensed, and I know certainly there's a lot of ways to take advantage of people if you're doing things online, but I guess I'm trying to make sure it doesn't hinder too much because there are a lot of people that need to use online pharmacies. So can you give me a scope of what licensing would be like for an out-of-state pharmacy?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Colomb, an excellent question and one that I will try to answer briefly if possible. So under the current way that things are done through the Board of Pharmacy, when you register, you're essentially just providing information to the board to say, I exist and I may or may not send medications into your state. There is really no jurisdiction then over the medications that enter into the state by the Board of Pharmacy to say, well, do you have you provided counseling to those individuals? What is your facility look like? There really is no ability for the Board of Pharmacy to maintain a safety measure. If there was a violation, and that is essentially where this change was born out of, throughout the last 10 to 15 years, as you said, mail order and online pharmacies have become kind of a big deal. and this has not necessarily kept up with the ability to say, well, if you're going to mail things and provide services into our state, then you need to make sure that you abide by the rules that this state has put forward. So the changeover really is, it's not going to be overly burdensome to these companies that already mail a lot of prescriptions into multiple states. Usually if you start to mail prescriptions, you're very regional or national oriented. And so you have a whole department essentially dedicated to making sure that you're up to date on your licensing. You have to do that in all the other states in which you're occupied or doing business in anyway. And this would just join us in with the others.
One follow-up.
Follow-up.
So is there fees connected to either one, the registry and licensing? Is there an increase in fees, or do they even have to pay a fee to register?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne, there are fees associated with licensing and registration. However, happy to report, and this was an answer to some of the questions about who pays for the executive administrator, the Board of Pharmacy has actually gone through multiple iterations of fee reductions over the last couple of years. In fact, one of our responses to the workforce concerns, particularly in regards to pharmacy technicians, was to essentially make their license free. All they have to do is pay a $25 initial license cost for the department, and then they can obtain a license. And that's down from $150, I believe, previously. So we've done a lot to reduce fees.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, Representative Ruffridge, any closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Representative Foster, Chair Foster. I certainly appreciate you scheduling the bill before you today. As I said in the opening, and as Dr. Shaver was so kind to be online and go through those slides, this is a very important bill, I think, for the practice of pharmacy in the state of Alaska. It is something that has been well vetted, gone through at least three chairs as of this moment. And so, you know, anytime you have a process that has gone through that many eyes and the ability for those people that are engaged in the profession to say, this is what we want our profession to look like in the state of Alaska, it certainly means a lot. And having the support of the association, as well as multiple members of the board throughout the years, is really a nice thing to see, and certainly would welcome the Finance Committee's support, and certainly happy to answer any questions offline as well. So thank you for your time today.
Great. Thank you very much. So we'll go ahead and set the bill aside, and our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is tomorrow, Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. We do have 9:50 in the morning. We've got floor for meeting with the Senate on appointees, confirmations. So with that, if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:49 p.m. Thank you.